Welcome to Little Atoms on Resonance 104.4 FM, a live talk show about ideas and culture, with an emphasis on ideas of the Enlightenment.
Little Atoms is presented by Neil Denny, Padraig Reedy, Richard Sanderson and Becky Hogg, as well as regular guest presenters.
Little Atoms actively promotes science, freedom of expression, scepticism and secular humanism.
Our guests bring ideas that are challenging, sometimes controversial, often polemical, but always interesting.
Good evening and welcome to Little Atoms. I'm Padraig Reedy. Hosting the show with me tonight is Neil Denny. And we're very delighted to welcome our guest this week, Greg Palast, who Neil will now introduce.
Thanks, Padraig. Greg Palast turned his skills to journalism after two decades as a top investigator of corporate fraud and racketeering. His reports have appeared on Newsnight and in The Guardian, in Rolling Stone and Harper's. He's a recipient of the George Orwell Courage in Journalism Award for his BBC documentary Bush Family Fortunes. Greg is the author of numerous books, including Armed Madhouse and The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, and his latest is Vulture's Picnic, which we'll be concentrating on tonight. But first of all, Greg, thanks for coming in and talking to Little Atoms today.
Fantastic.
I'd like to talk a little bit then about your years as an investigator, mm-hmm. rather than a journalist, and we'll talk about what the distinction is between those two terms, because they sound very similar. But tell us a little bit first of all about investigating corporate fraud.
Corporations commit fraud. In fact, let's put it this way. Corporations are fraud. And one thing, people ask me, how do I pick out my targets? Just close my eyes and point at the newspaper. Go down Wall Street in New York and fire a bullet and you'll hit a criminal. But, my big investigations are after the big guys, the nasty guys, the sharks, vultures, and fraudsters. I mean, Vulture's Picnic is after the worst of the predators, if they could be, worst within the kind of jackals club. So, my targets are BP. My targets are the big banks and Goldman Sachs, Exxon, and, of course, their lobbyists running dogs and henchmen and their poodles like Tony Blair and Cameron. I won't say Clegg because he's not even in the game. They may even reconnect his phone next year if he's a good boy.
One of the things you have on your resume is you were the director of the biggest racketeering case in history. So tell us what that was.
In American history, yes. I investigated the builders of nuclear plants in the United States for the U.S. government and the various levels of government. Massive racketeering case covering 12 years in which the power pirates had lied and lied and lied again about the safety of their nuclear plants, and most important was the cost, because it's always follow the money. They don't sit there and say, oh, we're going to build a nasty nuclear plant because they want to fry their own grandmother. They do it because they're willing to fry their own grandmother for a couple shekels. And I was able to get insiders. I have the notebooks of nuclear engineers. I've got their inside accounts. I've got the memos and the notes marked confidential between the chairman of the board and the president of the company. So these are racketeers. So I brought them to before a federal jury under the U.S. racketeering laws, racketeering influence corrupt organizations, RICO, little RICO, and a jury awarded $4.8 billion, shut down one of our big nuclear plants near New York. We nationalized turned into a consumer co-op, one of the biggest power companies in America, and put the nuclear plant builder Stone & Webster out of business. We thought. But when you stick a knife into a human, they die and you bury them. When you bury a corporation, it comes back to life at night in a different corporate shell. So Stone & Webster morphed into Shaw Corporation, the nuclear unit of Shaw Corporation. And in Britain, as nuclear powers come back from the crypt, Shaw Corporation, this company which was found guilty of racketeering, lying, fraud, endangering the public, stealing billions of dollars, this same company has been designated by Cameron and Clegg as the builders of the new nuclear plants that they are planning. Also, Obama has picked them as the builder of all four nuclear plants that he's approved, and they will be rebuilding Fukushima since they had some responsibility for watching this thing cave in the first place.
Has anything changed apart from the name? I mean, have they cleaned up their act, or is this the same people, but we've just did a new logo?
It's much more dangerous today. Because we used to have a very – remember, Greg Palast as you read in Vulture's Picnic, was able to go in, get their documents. I had rights to their internal documents as a government investigator. The public had rights to their documents. We used to have a document room where there was 1 million documents from this nuclear operator available to the public. No more, because we're fighting the terrorists, right? As if, the, you know, obviously, you know, Osama was, you know, they what they didn't tell you is that he was actually studying to become an investment banker. He realizes that's how you bring down, you know, America and Britain, right? And you know, he was like, you know, so we don't have that access anymore. And the laws have been crippled and they own the enforcement structure. And in Britain, it's really become a sick business. I can't – it's very hard to get inside and in Japan. So for example, you will see something in Vulture's Picnic starting the first chapter called the radioactive brick. Now, the radioactive brick was sent to me by insiders from inside this same Shaw Corporation, which the guys I had thought I had killed come back to life. But it also included discussions, meeting notes with the Texas – slime balls that were designated to build one of the new nuclear plants in America. And by the way, they also have had operations here in Britain. They own one of your power systems here in Britain. And the company that was brought in to be their beard, the company that the Americans brought in because they said, I know we have a bad record, but we'll bring in the best operators in the planet to control the building and operation nuclear plant, Tokyo Electric Power, which is the gold standard in the nuclear industry. So they're bringing Tokyo – and Tokyo Electric Power was involved in this. And the and what I got in what we call the radioactive brick, as you'll see, was documents that said we have told the government that the nuclear plant will cost around $5 billion per unit, which in nuclear fantasy land is considered cheap. But in fact, they already knew when they made the bid to the government that it would be $7 billion. But what you do is you get the contract, get the government to put up billions, and you say, oops, oh my God, all those greeny people are on our backs, so we have to change the safety standards, and things have changed. So now it's $7 billion each. Oops, we didn't know that. Oh, it's a surprise. No, it's not. It's fraud. It's racketeering. It's crime. That's what I found.
We've seen this week, you know, obviously the past couple of years have been rife with one financial scandal after another. This week we've had Barclays here, you know, suddenly found to have basically been scamming on a massive scale. But you mentioned at the start that the entire thing is a fraud. I mean, is this stuff, you know, has it got worse, or is it just the entire system is set up this way from day one?
The answer is yes. The entire system was set up this way from day one, but it has gotten way, way, way worse. Okay, really bad. And in the case of Barclays, you know, that you're talking about the LIBOR rate. What's very important is that that's the standard that sets all interest rates across the planet. This is a $1 trillion fraud. A $1 trillion fraud. And they're saying, oh, gee, oh, just some underling, just some clerks. Yeah, that's not nice. We'll throw some, you know, young trainees into the volcano if that'll satisfy you. Some, you know, virgin bankers.
I did like Bob Diamond's line where he said, I'll give up one of my bonuses. I thought that was lovely.
Yeah, but I don't think the blonde's going to go willingly into the volcano. So what I found, like, for example, in Vulture's Picnic, we have a document that I call the Magna Carta of Globalization, a secret document between between Geithner, Tim Geithner is now Secretary of Treasury, and Larry Summers, who was Secretary of Treasury, about a plan to force all nations to deregulate their banks, basically do the big bank where it'd be nuclear across the planet, a kind of financial nuclear winter. And they pulled this off. So we got this inside document. It's astonishing. But the most astonishing thing about it is that it has the phone numbers, the private phone numbers of the six most powerful bankers in America, Goldman Sachs, J.P. Morgan, Citibank, Bank of America. That, you know, basically these guys were sitting in a room figuring out how to basically wipe out all the planet's safety systems in the finance industry in 1997. This is where it begins. What's interesting to me, and by the way, those phone numbers are real. One of the first one of the first reviewers to get a copy called Citibank and got to the CEO. And Mike writes to me, he's like, oh, have you read any Greg Pallas stuff lately? And it, like, click. But now they've changed numbers. But yeah, those are the real thing. So they really do sit in a room and decide what to do with our planet. But the interesting thing to me is that all those bankers that were in that room that said, go ahead, Geithner, light the fuse, they're all gone. And the reason why they're all gone is I know all of them. Because remember, I was a student of Milton Friedman, so I actually moved in these circles. They wanted to blow out. They wanted the freedom to run naked, you know, turn the financial system into a casino. But they still thought that, well, they will set their limits. Mm-hmm. But the bankers wanted their bonuses. So they were thrown out because despite removing all the limits, they thought, well, we better be a little bit careful. We can't bring down the whole system. And he had guys that say, you're kidding, right? So that Goldman Sachs went in and said, why do we even have a rule that says that we have to keep, you know, 10% capital in case of a turndown? We're going to make it 3%. In other words, we can bet $33 for every dollar we keep as a reserve. And, of course, they got it. So it was like double or nothing, baby, because they knew. When the shit hit the fan, boom, you're going to end up with the public picking up the tab and blaming the public. You know, lazy Greeks, olive pit spitting, ouzo swilling Greeks that retire when they're 18 and work 3 hours a day. And so the kind of, they figure they can do this racial, lazy bastard stuff, pull it off, and they've pulled it off. They've blamed the victims. Even Mervyn King from the Bank of England has said, the victims are getting killed here. Mm-hmm. But now he's shut up and he's gone, you know, he's quiet as they go along with blaming the victims, killing the victims. And when I say killing, I don't mean that metaphorically. It's gotten really bad. So bad. The only interesting thing now is that there's a huge fight within the top now about finally the ultimate vultures moving in. There's a split now.
I want to talk about what was the point. You were working as an investigator, a government investigator.
Yes.
Now you're an investigative journalist.
Yes.
So what was the sort of straw that broke the camel's back? What was the point that made that transition? Why did you stop being a government investigator? What happened?
I did the Exxon Valdez investigation.
Yeah, exactly.
And I did that for the natives of Alaska, who owned the shoreline of Alaska that was crapped all over with Exxon's oil. But by the way, you will note, if you read the book, and I'm giving away nothing because there's so many stories in the book, BP was actually, British Petroleum was actually the real culprit there, or the bigger culprit. I'm not letting Exxon scum off the hook. But BP was in charge of stopping the oil spill, containing. They lied and lied. Where the ship hit, BP had promised to put right on Bligh Island. Remember, you know, like Captain Bligh, that's named after him. Bligh Island, which is where the ship hit, was supposed to have a lighthouse and all this safety equipment. It would be like starting a fire in front of a fire department. Should have been out in a minute. Should have been contained. They lied. Because they figured, who's going to check out there? It's just icebergs, Indians, and seals and whales, right? So when the ship hit, none of this equipment was there. So the oil destroyed 1,000 miles of coastline, destroyed the native properties. And I couldn't get that word out. It was all about a drunken skipper hits a reef. The Exxon captain, he was drunk. He hit, you know, like he's a drunk driver. It's stupid. That didn't happen. It's a con. It's a fraud. And so BP, Exxon had turned off the radar on the ship. The captain was not at the controls. It was all a con. And BP was supposed to have contained this thing. They're all lying. They're all giggling. So they're paying a few bucks and getting out. It's like a permit to pollute. So you see the same damn thing happen in the Gulf of Mexico, where, again, BP and Chevron and Exxon and Shell all agreed to have all this equipment out there in case something happened, and it didn't and there was nothing. No, by the way, that's no one seems to have brought that up. Where was it, even though the Deepwater Horizon exploded, it should have been surrounded, and there was no reason for that oil to spread all over the place. Okay? That's part of the book. So I'm investigating. But when I investigated the Exxon Valdez, and the story about BP was buried, and the real story of Exxon was buried, and the lawyers I was working with, I can't blame them, representing natives. They basically, their job was to get whatever money they could for these guys. And if we could, if they could be paid to basically bury the evidence, they would. So my evidence was buried. So now in Vulture's Picnic, I've unburied it. They can sue me if they want to, but they're not going, you know, they, I think a lot of people are grateful that it's come out. But I sat there in a canoe, in a kayak, in the Prince William Sound, saying, that's it. I'm done. I'm not doing any more. I have too many investigations where I have the truth and it gets buried, or like cases like, you know, like with this nuclear plant builder, they come back to life. And I want to, and it never gets covered in the press. And so I want to tell the story myself. That was it.
So this brings us nicely on to Vulture's Picnic, because all these years later, BP comes back into your life. Let's talk a little bit. Tell us, just fill us in on what happened with Deepwater Horizon, just very briefly. What was
very,
the actual
very briefly, I'm in Vegas with Ms. Badpenny, my sidekick. Boom, Deepwater Horizon blows up April 20th, 2010. My ex-wife's birthday, Hitler's birthday. I can't forget it. Deepwater Horizon. And she gets a message from a ship floating in the Caspian Sea saying this is not the first BP blowout. That BP had a rig that blew out in the Caspian Sea 2 years earlier. Mm-hmm. And for the same damn reason, cheap crap cement that they used to speed up the drying, it saves the company millions of bucks. But it blew out and they covered it up. So, and they kept doing this procedure. By the way, some of the other oil companies which knew about it kept quiet too, but they stopped using the cheap cement. Mm-hmm. Not BP. So now it's not an accident. It's a homicide, negligent homicide under U.S. law, right? So, but on the other hand, wait a minute. It's a tip. This guy's not going to come forward. He's scared to death. It's the Caspian Sea. This is the Islamic. This is Azerbaijan, you know, the Euro song contest. You know, when you're not going la, 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 they're cutting your fingers off, okay? If you say anything about BP, because I call it the Islamic Republic of BP. So I have to get in there to confirm that in fact there had been a prior blowout, which BP covered up. I get there. I go across the desert in a trackless road across to the BP terminal to find a witness. And someone's ratted me out. I get busted with my camera crew by the secret police. They're not that secret. And they take the film. Mm. Of course, they want your film, but they didn't take my pen, which Badpenny had given me one of these like Austin Power jobs with the video in it. So I got the information out, the bust out, so I got my own behind out of there. But I still didn't get, by the way, the witnesses all disappeared. So I actually didn't get that witness information to prove it. But then we had another whistleblower, a guy named Bradley Manning, Private Bradley Manning, who released the Secret State Department cables called, you know, which are called the WikiLeaks cable. They're Manning cables. And one of them, a series of them, were from the U.S. Embassy in Baku, in which BP's president, BP's own president, is called in by the U.S. Embassy, who are freaked out because Chevron, the U.S. company, Chevron and Exxon, Chevron saying, where's our money from the Caspian Sea? And the answer is that, so BP says, because there was a blowout and the cement failed and there's mud, as they call it, all over the platform. And, you know, we had this disaster, but quiet. Then BP, Chevron, Exxon, the three companies that were involved, went before the U.S. Congress 6 months before the BP blowout, testified that all was fine. So they covered it up. And the interesting thing is, why didn't the State Department tell the U.S. regulators, the U.S. Congress? Because whose State Department is it? It's not the public's. Condoleezza Rice was Secretary of State. She was on the board of Chevron Corporation for 12 years. There's a tanker Condoleezza, right? So the State Department, the embassy, was working for Chevron, not for the American public. So the U.S. State Department and the big oil companies covered up the prior blowout. BP continued to use the same deadly, cheap method, and the Deepwater Horizon blew out. That's the story.
Greg, you're kind of famous. You're one of the most famous investigative journalists in the world. But there's a lot of concern these days about how investigative journalism can continue, how this real kind of muckraking, going through every single file and talking to every single person you can continue when there's no money left, basically, to do this.
Yeah.
You're somehow managing to do that, but with a different, slightly different kind of model from the traditional model.
Yeah, what I have to do is, because it's really expensive to go to, I went to Baku, I then went to the Arctic, I went to the Amazon. Well, I Channel 4 dispatches paid for me to go. I talked them into sending me to Baku, but then they flipped out. They said, get out of there, you're endangering the crew. Well, that's what I do for a living. What do you come on, you're on a Greg Palast investigation, you know? I don't actually try to put myself in danger, but, you know, I'm not going to avoid it if that's what I need. And then once, to get into the Amazon, BBC gave me enough money to get into the Amazon, but not to get out. So I actually had to send out an appeal. And so I have a not-for-profit foundation in the States, the Palast Investigative Fund, and people donate to the fund to do investigative reporting. And what I don't go to big foundations. I have small, you know, you give $100, I'll send you a signed book. But the idea is that it is citizen-supported journalism. And while you may see the results on BBC or Dispatches or in The Guardian, they only cover a small part of this tremendous cost of investigation and the team, you know, Ms. Bad Penny and Maddie Pass and Oliver Shikles, who's, by the way, on my team, but he's also head of queers for Bradley Manning, by the way. So who, as far as I'm concerned, is the real Absolutely. Top journalist in this world because he's revealed the truth. So we have to basically support ourselves. And that way, I'm also not dependent if someone says, if you keep up this crap, I'm not, you know, you can't work here anymore, which I hear all the time. So I say, fine, do your worst. I'm still going to, if I, no matter what I do, I will get the word out.
So you come up with the project and then say to the people involved who want to get involved in the trust, if you want to give me money for this.
Here's what we're doing. Yeah. We announce what we're doing. So we don't always can't always announce our targets. Sometimes I'll say I got a hot piece of paper and I got to follow up on it. But you know, we say what we're doing, and then also I make a tremendous amount of the information free and available on the internet. If you go to gregpalace.com, you can get just about everything. I make sure that I own all my BBC films so I can put them on the internet. And if someone complains here and it's taken down, I can put it back up. And so it's very, very important that I have that independence. And so citizen journalism is very, very is vital. In the U.S., almost no papers are now supporting investigative journalism. It's all done by big foundations, though, and I don't want to be owned by these cats either.
You mentioned there the work that's been done for the BBC and for Channel 4 and Guardian. You know, they're all British organisations. Our more astute listeners will notice that you're an American.
Yes.
So you've just mentioned this idea about the big foundations, but why is this stuff not being done by the media in America?
The media in America is totally owned and controlled. There's no chink in the wall. You do have BBC, and believe me, I know that people here are saying, oh my God, you know, that's controlled too. But it's still, in the end, it's owned by the listeners in the end. The Guardian is a not-for-profit charitable trust that runs it. That makes a huge difference. Channel 4 is still not – it has advertised, but it's still, you know, not a for-profit entity. That makes a giant difference. In the U.S., there is no such thing. Even our so-called public broadcast system, I call it the petroleum broadcast system, it's completely owned by Chevron. They even have the Chevron logo at the top of their site. So it's like they're more controlled than even the Murdoch's networks. And, you know, that's the problem. So it's in the U.S., it's really terrible. So citizen journalism also means citizen dissemination, where I put the stuff out in the U.S. My BBC and Guardian reports have tremendous coverage throughout the internet in the U.S. It's one of the things that drives those websites where they have – there are more people who watch read The Guardian in the States than in Britain because it's the only place that they can get that news that I can put out on those reports. And if I can't get it there, I just – you know, we have Truth Out, BuzzFlash. We have all these internet organizations. The newspapers in America are dying, thank God. The big networks are dying, and I can't wait for them to sink into the tar pits. And then I can actually get them out of the way when I report.
Most of the talk in this show has been around the oil companies, BP and Chevron, but Vultures Picnic talks about another group, and we're talking about individuals here, the Vultures. Let's talk about who the Vultures actually are.
Yeah, the Vultures are like actually very important to know about the Vultures and Vultures Picnic. They are now the number one donors for Mitt Romney.
Mm-hmm.
So that's very important to understand. So what they want now, they want to roost right in the White House. And even the big bankers who back Obama are scared. He's backed by those big banks that I've read off before. And what they do is they're like, they want things to die. Goldman Sachs is a sucker squid that needs to, you know, sucks off living things. But the Vultures want things to die. So, for example, Paul the Vulture Singer, who's a key guy in here, just recently he bought Greek debt for pennies on the euro. Then when the deal was cut, where everyone, where the Greek people were eaten alive, but the bankers did agree to take an 80% cut in their principal. Okay. Singer, who only paid a small part, demanded 100% payment plus interest plus penalties. Singer and his partner were the only people on the entire planet. You're talking tens of thousands of bondholders. The only people on the planet who said, we don't buy the deal. We want everything. And by the way, the Greek government wrote the check for everything for this guy. And he said, because if you don't give me everything, I'm going to declare a default. Every bank in Europe will be technically bankrupt. He is like a – these are financial terrorists pulling the pin out of the grenade in the helicopter. That's what they're doing. And they are scaring the hell out of even the mainline banks. But they're the ones who are trying to seize the White House right now. So that's what I'm concentrating on. These are people who are going after the weakest, poorest people on the planet, like the Congolese. Taking up old, you know, they pay bribe. Like I hunted down in the beginning, you have Goldfinger, the real Goldfinger, not the cinema one. The cinema one's like Santa Claus compared to the real one. The real Goldfinger bribes the president of Zambia. We follow the president of Zambia to Geneva and film him, you know, on a shopping spree with $1 million cash. And what he's agreed to do for the bribes is basically pay a so-called debt, which is obtained through bribery, and basically give what was meant to be the AIDS money, the AIDS medicine money that was given by Britain and America and the European community to Zambia, and it ends up in Goldfinger's pocket. You know, just evil.
We'll have to leave it there, my friend. We could have talked for a lot longer. And if you'd like to hear more of what Greg was talking about, it's available in Vulture's Picnic in all good bookshops now. Thank you very much, Greg Pallast.
Yeah. And I would, if I could just add, if you go to vulturespicnic.org, you get information on the book, but you also get the backup documents, and there are videos which go with each of the chapters. So if you go to vulturespicnic.org, when you get the book, you can actually watch some of this stuff with it.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, thanks.
You've been listening to Little Atoms. You can find details of upcoming guests at our website, littleatoms.com. The Little Atoms podcast is available on iTunes. Thanks for listening.